all three of us?
Furious. You could just move on.
Order the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness, and I would remind everybody to please turn off your electronic equipment. It's not enough just to have them on mute. They must be turned off or else they affect the sound system. So please be sure everything is turned off. I get very cranky when I hear a cell phone. And I'm going to open up a work session on 2290. And if our committee administrator will talk to us about that.
Thank you, Chair. House Bill 2290 is a measure that would clarify the kinds of facilities that are covered by the Department of Human Services Foodborne Illness Prevention Program. Under the current statute, the Department of Agriculture oversees a number of health food regulations for entities other than restaurants. DHS would have the essentially almost jurisdiction for restaurants, and under the measure, Department of Ag would continue to have jurisdiction for food processors, food retailers, grocery stores, delicatessens, and other related entities. So it's, for the most part, a clarification of the current existing practices.
And we did have a public hearing on this earlier, and we had lots of testimony, so I'm ready to move the bill. And does anybody have any questions or concerns that they want answered before we take a vote or hear a motion? Okay. Yes.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I would move House Bill 2290 with a due pass recommendation.
So Representative Cowan moves House Bill 2290 to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
I'm sorry.
That's all right, Representative.
Could we just have another reminder of this? I'm having a little trouble. So who testified? I'm just not clicking in on this.
No problem. No, it's early in the morning. So I'm going to let the administrator.
There were, believe I, Representative Gilliam, Andy Smith, for the record. There were, I believe, two individuals that testified, one from the department and one from the DHS and one from the Department of Ag. The measure itself was submitted at the request of the Department of Agriculture. But it's my recollection that both departments testified in support of the measure. But with no concerns, I think, would be more accurate for DHS.
So it's a clarification, not so much an addition or...
Is anyone in the department here who would like to answer his questions? That would be great. Thank you. No problem. Just want to make sure you know what you're voting on. No problem.
Madam Chair, my name is Ron McKay. I'm the administrator of the Food Safety Division at the Oregon Department of Agriculture, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great.
Well, since I'm the one that brought this up, just your additional summary, perhaps, brief as you'd like to make it. I'm sure that'll be of help to the crippled up here. Go ahead.
Yes, sir. Representative Tomey. Representative Gilman, both the Department of Agriculture and the Department of Human Services have responsibility for food inspections and establishments in the state of Oregon. Department of Human Services is responsible for restaurants, food service facilities. Department of Agriculture is responsible for retail stores and bakeries and food processors. The term food dispensing, as it's used in 624, is not defined. And this was simply a clarification to change the wording to food service facilities so that there would not be any confusion in the event of any type of a problem.
And food service, as you would define, like, may I ask?
Sure, of course. Follow up.
And food service is, again?
Madam Chair, Representative Gillum, the food service is restaurant activities, catering activities, the type of establishments where food is offered for immediate consumption.
I just want to show you here, so you do food service, rather than saying dispensing, changing it to food service that are subject to licensing. It just clarifies who all the bill covers.
Okay.
It's just sort of a housekeeping. Okay?
Thank you.
You bet.
Thanks a lot for your answers.
Yes, sir.
Any other discussion? All right. Clerk will call the roll, please. Oh, all in favor say aye and opposed nay.
Aye.
Aye.
Aye. This is a roll call.
Okay. We'll do the roll call.
I won't change my vote.
You might change your vote by then.
Aye.
President
Gelser?
Aye.
President
Gillian?
Aye.
President Kutek?
Excuse.
President Maurer?
Aye.
President Olson?
Excuse me.
Aye.
Okay. Representative Olson is excused, as was Representative Kotek. Okay. Moving on. So I close the public hearing. Oh, the motion carries. We'll go to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Now, I'm going to close the public hearing on 2290. Okay, close the work session on 2290. Thank you. All right, and we will move on to a work session on 2193. I will open a work session on 2193. All right, Andy?
House Bill 2193 is a measure that would increase fees on tanning devices, x-ray machines, and also some microwave equipment, which are currently regulated by the Department of Human Services. It modifies terms of some of these periods of registration, and this is a fee that has not been changed since 1993.
All right. Would anybody like to make a motion? And we can discuss it after the motion. Let's discuss it then. Thanks.
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that House Bill 2193 be moved to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Maurer moves that House Bill 2193 goes to the Ways and Means Committee with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I do have a question, and it has to do with the frequency of inspections, and I was wondering if I saw him. Thank you.
Yes.
Madam Chair, my name is Terry Lindsay, for the record. Representative Maurer, in terms of the question regarding the frequency of inspections, in Oregon Administrative Rule, we do specify the inspection frequency for each of the types of facilities in X-ray program. I did share that with Jane Myers with the Oregon Dental Association, and she agreed in terms of that it is in rule. It is not in statute.
Could you please clarify with whom you work?
My name is Terry Lindsay, and I'm the manager of the Radiation Protection Services section within the Public Health Division, Office of Environmental Public Health.
Great, thank you. Any other questions?
Just to follow up to that, so there, from a technical standpoint, the frequency of inspection is based on the industry standard, I'm assuming?
Madam Chair and Representative Maurer, it is based upon perceived need, I guess, it's been a point of discussion within our department. It has to do with risk. It has to do with the type of x-ray machine that is used. The dental machines, the output in radiation is much less than it is for some of the radiographic machines that are used in hospitals or in industrial settings.
Okay. I'm going to let that go.
All right. Thank you. Did you want to add something, sir?
I just wanted to introduce to the committee, this is Dr. Gary Gates. He's the chairman of our Radiation Advisory Committee, and if there were any questions related to that, he's available also. So.
Thank you so much for coming. Any questions of either of these gentlemen? All right. Thank you very much for coming. All right. I would entertain a motion. Oh, we already have a motion on the floor. Any further discussion or questions? Okay, Representative Maurer moves House Bill 2193 to the Committee on Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. I will please vote aye if you want to see this bill passed, and no if you don't, and we're going to ask the clerk to call the roll.
Representative Gilliam? Aye. Representative Gilliam? Aye. Representative Delson? Aye. Excused? Representative Maurer? Aye. Representative Olson? Aye. Okay,
so bill motion carries, and who would like to carry this? All right, great. Representative Olson will... It doesn't go to the floor, so right? So it'll just go to Ways and Means, so you don't need... You're excused. Okay. So this House Bill 2193 will go to the Committee on Ways and Means with the due pass recommendation. And I close the work session on House Bill 2193. Okay. Okay. I'm going to reopen the work session on 2290. Because we need a carrier of this bill. So would you like to come out? Representative Maurer, would you like to carry this bill?
Madam Chair, I'd be honored.
Great. Thank you. So I will again close the work session on 2290. All right. Now we have, so Representative Lim is not here. Okay, so I see that Dr. Susan Allen is here, so we will open up an informational meeting. Bob Nickel will be here later. Susan Allen is here. Let's see, I do this. So welcome, Dr. Allen.
Thank you so much. It's a lot to present here. For the record, I'm Dr. Susan Allen. I'm the State Public Health Director and the Director of the Public Health Division within the Oregon Department of Human Services. And I appreciate very much the opportunity to provide a little more information about this extremely varied series of programs that are encompassed within the Public Health Division in Oregon, and also to have an opportunity to answer your questions. Last week I had a chance to set the stage with a few items. I think what I'd like to set for the context is a reminder that public health services are quite different on the whole from medical services in that in some ways they're older and more basic, and they set the stage for health for everyone in our communities. These are the services that provide have created the primary differences in our health today compared to the health back in the mid-1800s, late 1700s, or the difference between what we have in the United States compared to visiting a developing country, Honduras or someplace in Africa, for example.
Allen, could I stop you just for a second? Would you mind moving to the other microphone? This one seems to have static, and I don't think this one does as much, does it, Susan? Okay.
I'm sure you want to go down there and fix that thing for us. We got a garbage can around here, I think.
Terminator.
Sorry to be irritating with the mics. I hope this will work a little bit better. And
it's
also,
not you. Believe me, it's happening.
If I need to move it someplace, please just give me directions as well. The difficulty with describing what public health is doing is that it's most when it's working, you don't see it. It's when it's not working that you see the problems. So when it's not working, you end up with drinking water that's not safe, or you end up with food. You just heard about the importance of food inspections, for example. If we're not providing immunizations to our children, you get measles or polio outbreaks. When we're doing these things right, it sets the stage for the health of everybody in every community. A few of our services are provided in a way that looks sort of like medical care. We do family planning and things like immunizations, but even those are usually done in a different place and in a different manner than what traditional medical care does. They're much more likely to be given in the community with community outreach and a community scope. Something like family planning, the purpose for providing that isn't just the welfare of the woman. It's really the welfare of the family and the whole community, because that's where the benefits come from. It. There's a multiplier effect to the things that are done in public health. Investigation of a tuberculosis case, while it's important to treat the individual case, the real reason that that's a public health program is that it multiplies the value by limiting the spread of disease in the community. So our perspective is in some ways quite different from medical care, although there's certainly an overlap, and it sets the stage for everybody to be healthy. We talk about that our patients are every community in this state, that every day, every single Oregonian uses public health services in some way. When they turn on the tap or, pick up a latte on the way to work or try to breathe clean air, or when their children go to school and know that they're not going to be exposed to disease outbreaks. Having said what the framework is, I need to say that this capacity to protect people every day in every community in Oregon is seriously at risk in this state. The state funding for public health in Oregon is in the lowest five of all states in the country. What that means is that the majority of our budget and funding, and also therefore our programs, are driven by federal categories, which provide many valuable services. Our emergency preparedness money and program is entirely federally directed because it's entirely federal money. Family planning, we're able to some extent tailor to the state's needs. Many of our other programs are not as adaptable to what a specific state would need, and the federal guidelines are not normally written with states like Oregon in mind. They usually have a different state model, which frequently means that we're trying to take a kind of a rectangle and shape it into a triangle for what the state needs, in effect, which causes a good deal of strain on the system, and also means that where most states put state money in to allow for the adaptation and the kind of wraparound to meet the state's needs, that's something that we're struggling with in this state. This affects the communities very directly. At the state system, we have over 100 programs. About half of our programs are provided directly by state staff, such as the radiation program you just heard about. That is actually state staff who do that program. The food service program or the immunization program are examples where the 34 local health departments do the direct community part of the services. And then the state staff provide the overall wraparound framework. We deal directly with the federal government. We provide a level of technical support that you would not expect a local health department to be able to provide. So that partnership is important. We are the source of primary funding for our local health departments as well. And in many communities, this is pretty meager at the moment. They're good people doing the best they can, somewhat against the odds. Public health has seriously lost ground in this state in the last 20 years. Programs like our EMS program that many years ago, or our drinking water program, that 20-some years ago were actually considered outstanding among states, are now below marginal. They're actually deficient. Federal assessments of a number of our programs in recent years have found us to be seriously non-compliant with basic professional standards. In almost all cases, that's an issue of resources. That's true. Our radiation program, our drinking water program, we have about 115 of our drinking water programs in the state that are not meeting federal safe drinking water standards. And we have over 900 drinking water systems that are very small in the state that are not required by the federal programs to be inspected. There's actually a state requirement we inspect them, but nobody is. So we have over 900 small drinking water systems that are getting no monitoring for safety at all. The large systems do a good job, but there are only four very large systems, and there are over 2,000, I think it's 2,699, something like that, total drinking systems in the state. And the medium and the small systems really need the state technical support. They're not in a position to hire full-time professions. That's an example of what is of concern to all of us about whether we're adequately able to protect people in the state at the moment in many different ways. Our children's immunization rate, I think it's something like 650,000 doses of vaccine that our program distributed. So we meet the needs of many people in many ways. But for all of that considerable effort around vaccines, our children's immunization rates are also very low, well below what the expected standards would be for many states.
Dr. Allen, would you be open to asking questions, or do you want to make your whole presentation and then have questions at the end?
I'm here to provide information of value to you, and I've sort of set the general framework. I have a couple other programs I'd like to mention specifically before I'm done, but I'd be glad to take questions.
Go ahead. I'm writing myself some notes.
Okay. Fine. I mentioned our EMS trauma system, and you're aware that we're trying to raise the visibility and the formality of that program and also reinstate it to its previous state of excellence. We need to provide more community-based support for people who are trying to do the very difficult jobs of EMT services. So we need frameworks for setting standards, but also for supporting communities and meeting those standards. We do many community-based prevention activities. You're aware of the tobacco program, another example of a program that in some ways was quite outstanding and has lost some ground, and we're optimistic about this year being the opportunity to reinstate that to its previous levels of success. Emergency preparedness is in some ways almost becoming the framework within which most of our programs are now being considered and working. And the importance of that is, I think, for one thing, it's long overdue to recognize that most major emergencies include a health or medical component to the emergency. And even with the physicians and hospitals often being the primary resource for the response, the framework and the authority for that are in the state and local health departments. We're catching up to where we probably should have been a while ago, but we're not fully there with being able to blend and establish the overall plans, training, and framework to coordinate with the other emergency responders. The caution is that this isn't just for when kind of the big one hits, but we're really noticing that even with a norovirus outbreak or something like the E. coli with spinach event, that the issue of our being able to coordinate across medical systems with other systems, emergency responders, and really be established as lead for emergency preparedness has also become much more pressing. In light of that, we not only are doing various kinds of training and outreach, but we've examined the state's laws for giving us the tools that we need to protect people and found that they were deficient as well. So one of the ambitious legislative proposals we have is around the goal of strengthening and better defining our public health authorities to identify risks and hazards in the community and to be able to control them in a way that both protects the community better than we currently can, but also that protects the individuals who may be subject to investigation or treatment better than our current laws do as well. And we have a rather lengthy and detailed proposal for how to strengthen our ability to take our roles properly in emergency.
Thank you so much, Dr. Allen. I have lots of questions, and I'll bet other people do too. So who would like to ask the first question? Representative Mallett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. A couple issues. In the last thing you just talked about, essentially what you're talking about are the quarantine laws. Is that correct? And social distancing and that jurisdictional framework, is that what you're talking about?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, those are a big part of it. Quarantine and isolation, mandating vaccinations in certain high-risk situations, also the ability to set guidelines for what physicians and hospitals might be doing if we had shortages or particularly high-risk situations where we needed to address them in a different way.
Okay. Follow-up different area. tobacco prevention. What is your general fund this year in the governor's recommended budget?
I'm sorry, I don't have that at my fingertips. I've been relying on the excellence of others. Let me just see. Katie stepped out, and she may know, but we will follow up with that information.
Okay.
If she comes back in, we can ask Katie King, I think.
And then just one last comment. And my comment is that I think that, you know, I come from a rural part of the state, and that public health is hugely important, and that it does need to be funded adequately because the issues or the consequences of not having an adequate public health program are not known until it's too late, as you said in the beginning, and the consequences can be devastating to communities and to the state. So,
thank you, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
You're welcome,
Dr. Allen. I'm curious. You talked about the drinking water standards. And you mentioned, I think it was 900 small systems that are going unmonitored today because you don't have the resources. What's the definition of a small water system? Because I'll tell you the reason why, because as soon as you said that, I'm triggering, well, I'm on a well system. You know, I'm thinking, it's not me.
Madam Chair, Representative Olson, I may have an expert here in the room with me, and I'll look to Gail to confirm, but it is not intended to cover individual one-person systems. They're with multiple connections, but it's up. I believe small systems are up to four connections.
Gail, would you like to come up?
We'll share this additional mic.
Thank you very much. For the record, I'm Gail Shibley, Administrator of the Office of Environmental Public Health, Public Health Division, Department of Human Services. First of all, in terms of the tobacco general fund and the governor's rec, are the round numbers $18 million.
General fund.
Is that the general fund? Okay. General fund. And Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, I'm not sure I caught the very first of your question. To make sure that I'm
the definition of the small system, the state managed ones.
Yeah, what comes under ORS 448 that is not subject to U.S. EPA regulations are 4 to 14 connections, serving for at least 6 months consecutively in a year. And so individual wells, you're absolutely right, we do not monitor them whatsoever. We do get data for about individual wells as a result of real estate transactions. We have boxes of that data. We don't have any people to try to even enter in that data, much less really understand what those data are telling us. But as you may know, that's Water Resources Department is focused on that. We have some advice and general guidelines in terms of wells that the construction of wells to help increase safety for drinking water. They shouldn't be shallow. They shouldn't be impervious, or they shouldn't be pervious, and so on. But that is not our direct responsibility.
Follow up. So, Gail, my understanding of a connection, and correct me if I'm wrong, is residences that are connected to a kind of a community well.
Madam Chair, Vice Chair Olson, yes.
Okay.
It might be, for example, let's say a mobile home park.
Sure.
And if you have, 10 homes, you run a public utility, and you are subject to all of the public health drinking water standards that exist. So that that's just one kind of example, but a very real one that we face in the state. These are retired folks who, they're not environmental engineers. They don't know how to run, how much chlorination shock treatment, what's the exposure rate, what's the, turbidity, on and on and on. And they need help.
Okay.
So I'm going to follow up on that. So what kind of help do they need? What do they need that they're not getting?
Madam Chair, it's a great question. I'm not quite sure where to begin. I don't want to undersell at all the terrific work that the county environmental health specialists, as well as the state folks, do. They are truly, no pun intended, swimming upstream here. We, at this point, are required to just provide kind of boots on the ground, in-person inspections of these 4 to 14 connections every 3 to 5 years. Generally, it would be every 5 years because they're all groundwater systems. 3 years typically for surface water systems that are a little more changeable. But right now, we don't do those inspections at all. We don't even know where
state doesn't.
The state, neither the state nor the county. Neither the state nor the county. No one. When I say we, I'm talking about the public health system.
If I may interject, Madam Chair, the issue, this is one of a number of programs where we have skilled technical staff who have the knowledge to do the job, but there simply are not enough of them. So in the prioritization with our radiation program inspections, with this program, with a number of our other program areas, with our EMS program, they have to prioritize to a higher risk category. We are required to do the federal inspections because that continues the federal money to the state, not only for drinking water, but also for the revolving loan fund, which has brought over $100 million in valuable capacity building resources to our water infrastructure. So what we will, it's not an authority, it's a capacity issue. So. May I also provide a correction? The reason I was blank, I'm sorry, on the general fund is because there is no general fund directly. The state money that goes into the tobacco program is not general fund, it's tobacco tax. It is tax, specific tax that is used as a framework for funding that. That's the $18 million will be state designated money that is categorically directed specifically to the tobacco program.
Okay.
That wasn't quite comprehensible, I gather.
And last biennium, or this biennium we're in, is what, $5.3 million ballpark?
About six is what I recall. About, I believe, we can provide the exact number, but it's approximately six.
Okay.
And we're doing a reinstatement to a prior level, plus possibly plus some additional. Yes.
Okay.
I'm going to get to Representative Cowan first, but finish up here, and then we'll get to Representative Cowan.
Yes, just very quickly, Madam Chair, members of the committee, I just also want to clarify, 921 of these 4 to 14 connections, that's what we identified up to 1996. We stopped counting in 1996. Frankly, we do not even know how many there are, much less where they are, what kind of risks they're dealing with, facing, that they may or may not know. Certainly we, when I say we, again, the state and the county, when we get phone calls, of course we try to help. We do, you know, we respond just as much as we possibly can, but there is no system to provide any sort of proactive, consistent oversight. We don't even know how many we've got.
Colleagues, I just find this appalling. I don't think this applies to anyone in my district, because we've got Portland Water and water in the North Clackamas area. But I just, if I were in a rural area, I just would be shocked at this.
May I follow up to that?
Yes, and then I'll
get you. Go ahead.
Okay, this is about the water. When you do an inspection on a water system, would you charge them a fee for that inspection?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, that's a licensing process.
May I, and I apologize, it's never good form to interrupt your boss, but I'm chuckling, actually, Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, because just so happens we have a little bill that is over in Chair Dingfelder's committee that I'm hopeful will be getting some movement that will, for the first time, allow us to charge a fee sufficient to recover the costs of providing this kind of what's called an on-site sanitation sanitary inspections called sanitary survey. Right now, there is no fee. It is federally funded, and state, we do get about $1.3 million, $1.4 million, for in state general fund. That leverages, about 2-to-1 federal money, and those are primacy dollars specific to provide the overall, assistance, again, for 25 connections and up. That state match, frankly, is not even sufficient to maximize the federal dollars that we have available to us. We are continuing to leave federal dollars on the table because we can't pony up enough match. This kind of fee bill will provide enough of that increment to, and will double because of the federal match and maximize all the federal dollars we have. And so I appreciate the inquiry and look forward to you having an opportunity to weigh in on whether or not a fee would make some sense so that we can do more of these surveys in a more timely way. Right now, we don't have those resources.
Representative Maurer, are you on that committee, Representative Dinkfelder's committee?
No, Madam Chair, I'm booked.
I know.
Madam Chair, if I may make a general statement, we have over 100 programs in the public health division, and the nature of the story that you're hearing about the drinking water programs, we could probably give you another 20 or 25 programs that you would hear similar concerns about, that there are major gaps in what we are doing compared to what people probably would want us to do and may expect that we're currently doing. So this is one very important program, and Gail has offered, if at any point you wouldn't be interested in further information, she and her program managers would be glad to provide more detail. But my real concern is to let you know that this is unfortunately not a unique story within the scope of our public health programs. Environmental in particular, but not only those, licensing and regulation of healthcare facilities, for example, we need to go in and inspect those. We have a very difficult time responding promptly. Basically, we have a choice. Do we go in routinely or do we promptly respond to complaints? We don't have the capacity to do both right now in that program and quite a few others as well.
Thank you, Dr. Allen. We may call you back, Ms. Shipley. Let's wait and see if Representative Cowan has a question to ask of you.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I don't actually have a question, but I can't contain myself. I appreciate your frustration and shock at hearing about one of these programs. I personally can't tell you how excited I am to see these folks here and to hear the sort of detail that we're able to discuss today. I'd like to offer, first of all, my kudos to Dr. Allen and to the rest of the management in the Public Health Department. I've been serving on the State Public Health Advisory Committee for a number of years now, and I'm really pretty well aware of the level of detail and challenges to the capacity of our public health systems, and certainly at the local level in the public health departments as well. As a county commissioner, I dealt with that daily for 12 years. It's time that the state of Oregon takes a look at the capacity and ability of our public health system to deal with the many challenges that we've been facing. It's for the good of our entire citizenry, and that important piece of the invisible nature of public health when it's doing its job, as compared to the challenges when something breaks in the system. The local public health departments and the program directors at that level have been doing an outstanding job for years with really with their one hand tied behind their back, and the dependency on county government and general funds to try to bolster that capacity. I know that we'll be speaking about some capacity building at that level, and I couldn't be more supportive of that process. I'm also an old EMT, and so when we talk about the emergency care system, and the challenges that it's facing, the opportunity to address some of those issues around emergency preparedness and support and training for local responders and volunteers, and an opportunity to address public health law and some of the critical pieces that we need to adjust. It's thrilling to me to be able to sit here and be part of that conversation. So I would urge the rest of us on the committee to really listen to these issues and to seriously try to move forward some help for our public health system.
Thank you, Representative.
Thank you.
Any other questions, concerns? I think you make an excellent point, and it's also very distressing to hear you say that this is only one issue of multiple issues that we need to be dealing with. And what I'd like to ask you, since you have so much experience in this, if you could meet periodically with Dr. Allen and maybe bring up other issues. We've talked a great deal today about the water issue, which is so startling. So if there are other issues that this committee should be hearing about, I would really appreciate, and we'll take time out of our what I know will be a very busy schedule, to hear about other issues that you want to alert us to that we should be dealing with here in the legislature. We hear a lot about health care, but I think often we think about health insurance. We just take it for granted that public health is being dealt with and that our water is safe. I mean, my water is probably being tested there in Milwaukee, so I feel safe. And as mayor, I was sure that it was safe. But I visit other places, and I assume when I'm going to other places to visit or going to visit other members of my family that I'm also drinking safe water. It never occurred to me to bring my own bottled water, and I don't want to have to do that. And in fact, if I remember, bottled water does not have to meet the same standards that municipal water does.
Madam Chair, that's correct. It's less well regulated.
Oh.
Madam Chair, take a deep breath. And I would be happy to work with Dr. Allen and the program directors to sort of winnow down what issues might be the most important that this committee hear about.
Please.
I'd
please
be honored
that.
To do it.
Great. I really appreciate that. Any other? Yes, Representative Maurer.
You know, I hate to end on negative notes. And so can I tell you something that I really appreciate on a weekly basis that you folks do, and it's a CD summary that's sent out. And I read it every week. And whoever writes that has got a sense of humor.
Yes.
And they are very articulate, and they summarize a public health issue on two sides of a piece of paper. I actually prefer the piece of paper I'm reading. Than an email, but anyway, I think it's a great thing. It's a great tool, and I know that people in our business in healthcare read it. So thank you,
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer. We're very proud of that. I think that's one of our most outstanding publications. It's written for a technical audience in a way, for a healthcare audience, but it is written with really excellent perspective and balance. We're aspiring to bring that same level of excellence and to get more of our information out. If you'll allow me one more opportunity.
Sure.
One of the other things that public health provides for the whole system is we're the data collectors about the health status in communities. So when someone wants to do a study of adolescent drug use or of falls among the elderly and so on, typically public health is the source of the study, the survey, the community assessment that provides that. So a lot of our other systems depend on us. We have not, in many other areas, done a very effective job of getting that information actively pushed out to people. And the CD summary out of our communicable disease program is a model that we're hoping to raise more of our programs to, so that other valuable information we have is more actively used by the rest of the community.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay. Before Dr. Allen goes, I think I've discussed this with several members on the committee. We're thinking about having a joint meeting with the Emergency Preparedness Committee, which is a joint Senate and House committee, and we're looking at March 2nd. So if you could put that on your calendars, it would be down in Lincoln City. And so we're hoping to do that. There's a big bill that Dr. Allen is encouraging us to pass, and it will probably at least start the public hearing process there. It would be nice if we could have a work session, but at least we'll start the process if everyone can make it. So thank you, Dr. Allen and Ms. Shipley also. Thank you so much.
Madam Chair Committee, thank you so much for your interest.
You're welcome. Okay. Okay, so I will close the informational hearing with Dr. Susan Allen and open up with a public hearing and a work session on Joint Resolution 11. So I think we have a couple of staff people here. I think Representative Lim could not come. Thank you, gentlemen. And if you could let us know your names and positions for the record, that would be great.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I'm Seth Hatmaker, Chief of Staff for Representative John Lim.
Sit back a little bit. Those are so...
And my name is Michael Kempton. I work in Representative Lim's office as well.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Sure.
Where they do it.
House Joint Resolution 11 is a measure that would recognize the month of September 2007 as the Alcohol and Drug Addiction Recovery Month. This resolution is related to a federal effort with the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration's program. And it was created, the entity that started with this tradition of September as this month provides national leadership in the federal government's effort to improve the lives of individuals and their families who are affected by alcohol and drug abuse. The Recovery Month provides a platform to celebrate people in recovery and those who serve them. It also is a time when their national efforts to educate the public on substance abuse and to inform the public that addiction is a treatable disease and recovery is possible. So that's some background on the national efforts around this measure.
Can I begin?
Yes, please.
And I'd just like to begin by apologizing for Representative Lim not being here. I know he's tied up in another committee at the moment, so I apologize for that. Basically, we've compiled some statistics that was put together by the U.S. Department of Human Services relating to drugs and alcohol, if you may have a copy before you. So far, they've said that statistics show that 22.5 million Americans age 12 and over were classified with substance abuse in 2004. It is estimated that 8.8% million were classified, or 8.8% between age and 12 and 17 were classified with substance dependence or abuse. In 2002, more than 26,000 people died of drug-induced causes. Some other facts and figures. 17 million under the age of 18 live in a household with a parent or adult who is a binge drinker, which is considered to engage in heavy drinking, such as 5 drinks or more in one sitting. 9 million who live with parents who use illicit drugs. In 2001, the total expenditure for the treatment of substance use disorders in the U.S. Was $18 billion. Just to add in some local figures, the Oregonian recently published an article based on a study that was conducted in Oregon that found that between students between 12 and 14, 34% of students who are girls were found to be drinking had at least one drink in the past 30 days. 30% boys had been drinking at least one drink in the past 30 days. And I just like to add in my own personal thoughts about this. I've unfortunately seen the effects of drug and alcohol throughout school, beginning both in middle school and high school. I got to see several friends be affected by this that began drinking and getting into drugs at a young age. And I've seen it tear apart their lives. And I think it would be important for people to be aware of what happens and hopefully bring about some change to better these people.
Thank you. Why don't we hear from you, and then we'll take questions. Did you have something to add to this?
Well, what I appreciate with your efforts, Madam Chair, is that, something like this, a resolution encouraging recognition is something that educates. So often people are afraid that what's coming out of Salem are mandates, but if we can educate, change the culture, I think in the long run that saves money and, much more importantly, improves lives. So.
Thank you. Thank you, gentlemen. Any questions? Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Gentlemen, I appreciate your bringing this forward today. I wondered if you might speak just a bit more, too, on the piece that talks about celebrating people in recovery and speaking to what I think we all need to be a bit more aware of, is that addictions treatment works, and folks can overcome their challenges both in addictions treatment and mental health treatment and move on and have terrific lives. And I'd like to see us emphasize the hope as well as we talk about this resolution.
Great point, Representative McCullen.
Perhaps they could talk. I see it is mentioned. I thought perhaps you might want to elaborate on the presenters might want to elaborate on that a bit.
Oh, Madam Chair, Representative Count, and the is there a specific point that we should elaborate on as far as the recovery aspect of it, or?
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to put you on the spot.
No. Just
apologies.
Clarification.
I guess I just intended that I'd like to emphasize that point that treatment works and we can celebrate recovery, and I, with apologies, didn't mean to put the presenters on the spot.
Representative Cowan, we will have three other speakers, and I would imagine.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Right?
I didn't have
you, Jim. For this, yes. And I think they may be talking about recovery.
Correct.
But you have made an excellent point.
I apologize. I jumped the gun on
speakers. No problem. Anyone else?
I just want to, Madam Chair, I mean, the whole idea and the concept of this bill really supports the efforts of what Senate Bill 267 did several years back for evidence-based practices as they impact alcohol and drugs, and mental health and crime. So, I think it's a great idea.
Great. Good. Thank you, gentlemen. We appreciate you coming.
Mm-hmm.
We hope our best to represent Glenn.
Wait.
Oh, yeah.
I just wanted to respond to Representative Cowan's comments. Did you happen to see the group that came around called Hope? You ended with the word hope in your comment. They're new to me, but they came around to my office, and they're looking for, they have a kind of a housing idea for folks recovering from mental health issues and addiction issues. And I just wondered if you had seen them, because it was a living proof of what you just said. There were six people in my office, all having recovered from either mental health issues or addiction. And they were just wonderful people who had put their lives back together and who are now trying to help others through a housing project. And it was like the best celebration that, you know, you could see. And I just wondered if they'd been to your office yet. Okay.
Thank you, Representative. Thank you very much, gentlemen. Okay, Representative is, I think, in Korean American Day, is that right?
Yes.
And he's doing those events today, so give him our best. So, Karen Wheeler. And why don't we have Deborah Gilmore come up at the same time? Oh, thank you. You can do that one.
It's too simple. What?
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Karen Wheeler, and I'm the Addictions Policy Manager with the Addictions and Mental Health Division, and we're part of the Department of Human Services. I'm proud to say that the department has recognized Recovery Month for a number of years, and in fact, for the past 5 years, we've co-sponsored the Hands Across the Bridge event up in Portland. And I don't know if any of you have had the opportunity to go to that event. The governor was there a couple years ago, but it's very exciting, uplifting, and it happens on September 5th, or Labor Day. I might have gotten that wrong, Memorial Day or Labor Day. I always get those two mixed up. Labor Day. Anyway, we want to stress, and it's been mentioned today, that addiction is definitely a preventable and a treatable disease. And I personally know many people in recovery, and I happen to know that people can and do recover. And Oregonians who are in recovery from addictions really do deserve our support, recognition, and celebration. and I'm very happy that the committee is recognizing this bill today. I would also mention that in March, there's an HBO series that will begin on addiction recovery. So this is getting national attention as well as in our state, which is a very good thing. And I would also mention that there's a bill being heard just a couple rooms away, and there are many people who represent the drug-free housing community in that room just a couple rooms away today. I would just like to end my comments by saying a quote by William Anthony. At the heart of the recovery movement is the idea that instead of focusing on the illness, emphasis is placed on the potential for growth in the individual. And I thank you for allowing me to testify, and I would entertain any questions.
Any questions for the witness?
Keep it.
Thank you. Go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Tomei. I don't know if the committee can hear me or not.
Yes.
I've been told my voice carries, so I'm very
You're fine. I think, right, Susan? She can be heard?
I'll watch you.
Okay.
Well, for the record, my name is Deborah Gilmore, and I'm the Executive Director for the Oregon Prevention, Education, and Recovery Association, also known as OPRA, and we are the statewide nonprofit association of prevention and treatment providers. We are the private providers across the state. We contract with a majority of the counties to provide treatment and prevention services. So we're the frontline organization, if you will, of the folks who are actually dealing with alcohol and drug abuse and addiction every single day. I'm here to encourage your support of House Joint Resolution Number 11 because it's very, very important to us that this issue not fall through the cracks and not take a backseat to other issues that may come before you during this legislative session. Our members are on the front line, as I said. There are no holidays. You know, when Christmas comes, people don't get the day off. Addiction is something that is addressed on a daily basis, and the people that are doing the work and are out there are doing it every single day, and they do it because, not for the money, because I can guarantee we did a survey, and the janitors in this building are actually making more money than addiction counselors within our association, so it's a very altruistic job, if you will, to get involved with, but we appreciate the opportunity to give some recognition to the field and also the ability to distinguish the successes that do occur through prevention and treatment, and would respectfully request your yes vote on HJR 11. And I'll take any questions you might have.
Any questions, witness? I have a question. Do you also treat gambling addiction?
Our association does not deal with gambling addiction per se, but our association is also talking about looking at addiction holistically, and that would include addiction to tobacco products and some other things. So it does come up in conversation, and there are parallels, and they certainly cross across numerous boundaries, if you will, when it comes to this. But specifically right now, we deal with alcohol and drug abuse and addiction.
Thank you.
Yeah. I comment on that. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, our office does.
Can you identify yourself again, just for
yes, Karen Wheeler, Addictions and Mental Health Division, DHS. Our division does administer the gambling treatment program and prevention program. And I would say, having been a counselor and a clinical supervisor in the private setting for a number of years, we provided addiction treatment, but we also provided gambling treatment.
Great.
So many of the programs do both.
Great. Thank you so much. Any other questions or concerns? Thank you, ladies. And now Gina Nickel. And is there anyone else who wishes to testify? Please come up.
Hi, Chair Tomei, committee members. For the record, my name is Gina Nickel, and I'm the Executive Director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Program. That's a little misleading. The title's really long. We also do the addictions programs and developmental disabilities programs. Our counties contract with OPRA to do about half of the addictions providing. We just wanted to come forward and say we are in support of HJR 11. We also do gambling.
Okay.
And I'll be glad to answer any questions. This is a good bill, do pass.
Thank you. Any questions of Ms. Nickel? All right. Thank you very much. Does anyone else wish to testify? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing portion of House Joint Resolution 11 and open up a work session for House Joint Resolution 11. Let's see. Representative Gilliam, I would entertain a motion.
Well, I'd be happy to make a motion on behalf of our friend Representative Lim and all those that have testified, Madam Chair. I move House Joint Resolution 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation.
Great. Thank you. Representative Gilliam moves House Joint Resolution 11 to the floor with a be adopted recommendation. Any objection? Any further discussion? If not, let's let the assistant call the roll call.
Representative
Cowan? Aye. Excused.
Representative Gilliam?
Aye.
Representative
Kotek? Excused.
Representative Maurer?
Aye.
Representative Olson?
Aye.
Chair Tomei?
Aye. The motion carries, and Representative Gilliam, would you like to carry the bill on the floor?
My pleasure.
Oh, Representative Lim will be carrying it.
My pleasure to carry it to Representative Lim.
How do we do that if somebody on the committee is not on the committee?
I believe it's a member of the committee that should carry it.
Okay. Cool. You don't think? Okay. We'll probably be a joint effort, but we're going to name you Representative Gilliam and along with Representative Lim to carry this on the floor. So with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Resolution 11. And we are waiting for Mr. Nickel, and we will take a short recess while staff goes to look for him. Call to order the House Committee on Human Services and Women's Wellness. And we have Mr. Nickel here.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Bob Nickel. I'm Assistant Director for the Department of Human Services, and I head up the office or the Addictions and Mental Health Office. Still not quite into the swing of the division name yet. But thank you, first of all, for offering an opportunity for me to come back and just spend a few minutes, and I'll try to keep it brief and just provide a little bit more information on the overview of addictions and mental health for the committee. I want to just talk about four related terms, some of which have already come up today in other contexts that you'll be hearing as we talk about mental health and addiction issues, and they apply, I think, equally well to both areas of addictions and mental health. And they are evidence-based practices, trauma-informed care, recovery, and cultural competence. And I'm not going to give you an hour lecture by any means on these four terms, but I just wanted to start off with evidence-based practice. That's a term that Representative Olson mentioned earlier. Senate Bill 267 passed in the 2003 session. And I think that the system that I'm responsible for has done a great job, really, of coming to terms with the bill and working hard to implement it. It's a very simple concept, I think, and that is we ought to be doing in the real world of practice what the research has led us to believe is effective. The two key things in terms of outcomes there are reducing psychiatric emergency costs and also, as Representative Olson mentioned, reduction in criminal involvement. I made a decision in my role as leader of the office to say that it's essentially applied to everything that we do. If we're not serving people who are at some risk in the mental health field of psychiatric crisis, then I'm not sure what we're doing. And secondly, if we can't make a difference in terms of criminal involvement with people with mental illnesses who, unfortunately, as you know, often end up in the criminal justice system and certainly with addictions, it seemed to me that we needed to apply this to all of the populations that we serve. So we've taken a pretty comprehensive look at it. It's certainly a direction that we were planning to go in anyway, but I really have to say that it's nice to have a statute to back that up. So evidence-based practice will be a continued focus. Our goal this time will be to show that 50% of the funds in 2009-11 I'm sorry, in 07, 09, will be going toward evidence-based practices. And then we have a pretty high goal of 75% that's set. And I hope that if we do this in good faith, and it looks like 75% is a very, very difficult goal to actually achieve with high fidelity, I'd like, hopefully, at some point to have a conversation here at the legislature about that issue. But that's getting ahead of ourselves. Trauma-informed services is another thing that I think is really critical. And since this is a committee that focuses particularly on women, I think this is an issue that affects nearly all women who have had a mental illness or an addictions issue. By trauma-informed care, we mean the increased recognition not only in our minds but also in the way we treat people, that many people have been traumatized either in childhood or after the development of an addiction or mental health problem. The rate of sexual and other physical abuse problems is large. I could get data for you if you'd like to see that, but it's something that we have to assume is there more often than not in addition to the addictions and mental health issues. And this plays out really at the very fundamental level of interactions between even support staff, clerical staff, and people coming in the door to an office area, that often people have been so charged up emotionally by past events that it's hard for them to even recognize the tone of voice and other issues that can actually affect how people feel about being in services. And then it goes much beyond that to the way in which professionals, and this is certainly an area, Madam Chair, where your concern that we not deprofessionalize things too much is really critical, because there are trauma-specific kinds of treatment that we need to be able to provide and offer to many people, men and women, who have had various kinds of trauma. Cultural competence is something that whenever I speak before a committee that Senator Gordley is on, she reminds me that that's something that needs to pervade everything that we do, and I could not agree more. I think particularly with the growing Hispanic population in Oregon and other populations of people with other cultures, that we need to be very much attuned to those, and certainly is something that my office has a cultural competency plan that we work on and that really does pervade a lot of the areas that we work in. And finally, the fourth concept that I just wanted to make sure that I mentioned and put on the record is the issue of recovery. It applies, I think, equally well in the addictions area as well as mental health. Recovery in mental health sometimes is not necessarily always the person getting back to the level that maybe they could have achieved had they not had schizophrenia or bipolar disorder. But we're finding that even in the area of employment, if we do supported employment services and we do it at a high fidelity, and again, this is an evidence-based practice, we should be able to eventually, if we fund this properly, get up to 70% competitive employment at least half-time, even for people who have schizophrenia. And this is a very different way of thinking about things than I was taught 25 to 30 years ago. So I think I just wanted to talk about these four terms. There are concepts, and there are also initiatives that the division that I'm in charge of is working hard on. It may not come out in everything that we talk about. We get lost sometimes in talking about the number of people we serve, the different settings in which they're served, but these are concepts that really cross-cut all of the different settings and all the different populations that we work with. So I think with that, I will stop. If there are questions, I'd be happy to answer them, but I just wanted to put these four ideas, concepts, initiatives on the record.
Thank you. Any questions? Bob, this is just the tip of the iceberg. I mean, you're just giving us a very short overview. I think this committee needs to delve into these issues much more deeply. And I think we need guidance from you where we need to go and what kind of education do we need so that we can educate other people in the building about how important these issues are. Mm-hmm. One of the issues that's especially important to me is recovery. I think so often when we hear about people who are mentally ill or addicted to drugs, that we sort of say, well, this is a lost cause, you know, especially when we're talking about the methamphetamine mm-hmm. addictions. Mm-hmm. And then we read about that in the paper, and I know we've had experiences with those. Mm-hmm. And we know that some of the people, when they first go into treatment, it may not take the first time. It may take two or more times. I'm not sure if it was you or somebody that I was meeting with recently was telling me the number of children who are in foster care, what huge proportion of those children, their parents, are affected with drugs, very often with meth. And we've, Representative Olson and I have talked a lot about the corrections community and how many of those people are also drug affected. And when we say corrections, sometimes that's a misnomer. Sometimes their corrections aren't done. It's taking people away from society, but very often the treatment is not there for those people. So when they come out of the corrections facility, they still have the problems that they went in with. And those problems magnify, and it affects their families. It affects society. Certainly when we hear about cars being broken into, burglaries, et cetera, that is tied to people being addicted to drugs and needing money for those drugs. Feels like I'm going on and on, and other people, please join me here. But it feels like we need a lot more information about these issues so that we can figure out how we as a committee can work on these and how we can encourage the legislature to be working on these issues.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'd be happy to work with you some more on how we might be able to provide some more information. I agree that it's important to a lot of the decisions we'll be making this session about where we're going in the addictions area, what about how this affects a new state hospital and community system. Do these ideas have relevance? I would suggest they do. But I think it would help us understand where we want to go as an agency for us to have that conversation with you as legislators. So we'd be happy to talk with you more about that.
Anyone else? Representative?
Yeah, Madam Chair, just for your information, Bob's office has been contacted to attend a meeting that we have scheduled next week regarding the LEDS connection, law enforcement data system with law enforcement dealing with mental health. And I mean, we're just going to kind of explore that and see how that might help law enforcement as well as the mental health community. So.
Great. Good. And this is a sort of a work group that you're putting together, right?
Exactly.
Right. Yes, Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for the presentation. I appreciate it, and again, these are issues that have been bubbling for a long time, and I'm really glad to see them beginning to get some attention. Certainly the focus on the connectivity between mental illness and law enforcement issues is one that we know that we need to explore. I don't want to slight any of the first three points that you were detailing, because I think those fall into the state responsibility area probably rather heavily, and they're very important to the overall system and treatment program. I think that I would just add to what's already been said, maybe on another level, the support at the community level. I'd like to try to focus a little bit more as we talk about changes in the state hospital and mental health programs, and oftentimes we just sort of slide that community-based support services in there, you know. And having had a lot of time at the community level and watching the challenges of providing adequate systems at the community level to truly support people in their recovery processes, I would hope that the committee could focus a bit on those kinds of challenges. Over the years, I've seen wonderful ideas come and go for transitional programs coming out of an incarceration, in recovery from addictions, and yet not being supported at the local level enough to be able to maintain that. And so I would hope that we could include in our conversations some look at what's needed in our communities to make these things work long term.
Thank you, Representative Cowan. Any other concerns or questions? So, Bob, what I'm going to ask you to do is contact my staff, or my staff will contact you, so we can set up more informational hearings about some of these issues, and we would appreciate your help in that.
Madam Chair, we'll be happy to do that.
So. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, I think I'm going to close the informational hearing in the Department of Human Resources. Any other business we should be dealing with? Any members? Seeing none, I will... the meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.